Hey, good morning. Great to be back with you. I still can't get used to that. I said this the first service, the way we do this, where there's kind of a welcome with applause in the beginning, it just adds to the pressure, honestly. Now I've got to live up to that, and it's always difficult to do, right? But anyway, I'm glad I get the opportunity to reel this series in, final message in our series called Hooked. Now, the first message I gave in this series, I shared with you how Jesus' plan was to call disciples and make them fishers of people. Key part in that plan for them to be effective was that they would deepen their insight and that they would grow in their compassion. I shared how Capernaum was the base of operations for his ministry, and from that location, he would train them to become mediators between him and a very diverse section of the population. Now, the disciples had, a number of them, the practical skills to be able to fish. But to be effective as fishers of people, there were spiritual changes that Jesus needed to make. And in that training, Jesus actually required that the disciples make intentional internal changes. Intentional internal changes. In other words, what we see in Jesus' ministry of preparation is that he trained the disciples on purpose for purpose. Trained them on purpose for purpose. Now, there were a number of issues that he tackled, but I think that there were four that rise to the surface when you look at his interactions with his disciples directly. I'm raising those four issues because I believe that those four issues continue to be issues that Jesus wants to tackle in his church to equip us to be effective in the mission that still exists, to fish for people. See, Capernaum was chosen for a reason. We saw in week number one that it was basically that gateway to the rest of the world. It was on that trade route from Egypt into the rest of the world. It was a diverse community. We saw from Matthew 17 how there were tax collectors, temple tax collectors there, who were there to ensure that the influence of Jerusalem wasn't lost in such a secular place. Capernaum was chosen for a reason. Many of you I know struggle with the secularization of America, but what we see in the training of Jesus is that Jesus was pretty clear that the solution to the secularization of the nation wasn't the introduction of a Christian state. You'll hear that. It wasn't the introduction of a Christian state. See, the Christian state that was basically driven by the idea of enforcing external rules and regulations on the people. That's why the temple tax collectors were there, ensuring that this idea of holiness as you entered the temple ultimately didn't just address 1 hour a week, okay, whenever they would go to the temple for the feasts, but ultimately became a part of daily life. They were there to enforce that regimen. That's not the way that Jesus thought. The way Jesus thought was exemplified in that text we read earlier on, 1 John chapter 5, where basically, if you love God, you do his commandments. Internal change is necessary for external behavior to change. Jesus knew that the solution, the antidote to a secularized state, was not the introduction of a Christian state, but the building of a church that would ultimately be committed to the proclamation of the gospel of Jesus the Christ, that would ultimately bring people to a point of what is called punctilia conversion, that moment in time where they confess Jesus to be their Christ, their Lord and their Savior, that results in that internal change on the inside that makes it possible to live the way that God intended people to live. Internal change, intentional internal change is the solution that Jesus saw being necessary to the secularization of the nation that he loved. Dare I say that we need to hear this message again today? The solution to the secularization of America is not the installation of a Christian state. It's not the imposition of basically centralized Christian law. It's actually going to come. Change is going to come as we are serious about fishing for people. See, Jesus wants to put us right to help us become a part of His, God's, putting the world to right project. That's the way the rule and the reign of God is extended. And sadly, over the last few years, we have witnessed Christian after Christian after Christian get this message wrong. And church, it's time to get it right. The antidote to the secular America is not the Christian state, it's the empowered church. And Jesus knew this, and He was intentional about this. And we see that through the four issues that He dealt with that I believe continue to be issues that Jesus is dealing with in us. So four issues. Issue number one, spiritual superiority. As Jesus equipped His disciples to be mediators between Him and the people, He needed to deal with their sense of superiority. No, this was an issue back then. Religious leaders, religious people felt that they were better than other people. This was an issue that Jesus needed to tackle amongst His own group too. Amongst that group, there were a number of fishermen. Four jumped to the surface. James and John, they were brothers. Peter and Andrew, they were brothers. The text, when you read it, is pretty clear that James and John ultimately came from the wealthy part of town. They had a large fishing boat. They had larger nets. They even employed other people. They were successful. They were wealthy. From Mark chapter 4, we note that Peter and Andrew seem to come from the other side of town. We know that because the text uses different words. Different word for boat, different word for nets, that ultimately suggests to us that their boat was smaller, their nets were smaller, and we know that they hired no people. You see the diversity here that Jesus was bringing into His ministry. By the way, I just want to say this, that what this spiritual superiority indicates is, as someone has said, diversity is being invited to the dance, inclusion is being invited to dance. What we witness in the behavior of James and John is that they were more than okay for people from the wrong side of town to be invited to the dance, just as long as it didn't mean that they danced with them. Diversity isn't enough. Inclusion means you invite people to really be a part of what you're building. James and John didn't like that. They still felt that they were better than people from the other side of town. We see this over and over again. Here's one indication of this. Mark chapter 10, verse 35 through 37. This is what we read. Then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to Him. Teacher, they said, we want you to do for us whatever we ask. Now, this seems kind of out there and rather arrogant, but let's give Him credit. Jesus says, ask anything you want in My name, and I will do it, right? So let's give them the benefit of the doubt here. Maybe this was motivated with the right intentions, but look at what they asked for. Jesus says, what do you want Me to do for you? They replied, let one of us sit at your right hand and the other at your left when you enter into glory. Now, this was an issue for them is clear because in Matthew chapter 20, their mom makes the same request. Nothing like having a mom go into the son's defense, huh? We clearly got a group of people here who have this smattering of elitist spirituality based on the idea that their economic standing, their social kind of position, ultimately gives them the right to basically be above other people. Now, let's remember, the text also says that Peter and Andrew and James and John were partners. But what kind of partnership do you have if one of the partners ultimately thinks and acts in a way that demonstrates he's better than you are? Is this really a partnership? Of course it's not. Elitist spirituality, I believe, is often present in the church today. takes different forms. In some churches, there are special seats for special people, for example. Now, while I was away, I was supposed to speak at the church that I grew up in. And the church that I grew up in, by the way, is smaller than our choir pit. Okay, it's a small little church. And I was supposed to do it, but I couldn't because COVID ravaged the church. Seriously, my mom got COVID. We were supposed to see her, but we couldn't see her for 2 days because she had COVID. But anyway, in that church, there's one thing I never liked. As I was growing up, there were always seats. How many of you had churches like this? There were always seats at the front for the important people in the church. You ever have that? One would be the pastor, maybe the elders, maybe somebody bringing the word that day. But they would ultimately be on that pulpit. Now, whenever I would go back to that church, I would hate that. And you know why I would hate it? Confession time. I just don't like people watching me worship. Any of you with me? I could never do what Hannah, Brooke, and everybody on the stage here do. I can't do that because, well, I'm basically like a monument next to my wife. I hated that. But because I was someone special, I would need to sit in the stage. Bless God that they actually got rid of that thing. Now, I realize why they do that, right? But there's some good things. But over time, what happens with this is this idea that that's where the important people sit. That's it. Leader spirituality creeps in that way. Of course, it creeps in other ways too, right? And in other areas of ministry, for example, some people won't serve in certain ministries because it's beneath them. Oh, I don't do that anymore. Why? Others refuse to serve because responsibility for leading that position or that ministry is ultimately be given to someone who they think they're better than. Leader spirituality. It's also visible, I think, today, and we need to be careful with this one. When we present ourselves to other people as superior because our ideology or our morality is clearly better than theirs. This is the big one, I think. As we journey towards November and conversations will continue about abortion, you're hearing this over and over again. I've heard Christian after Christian speak in such a way that it sounds like they're speaking down to people. That our morality is better than theirs because we take a different line on something. This is what James and John were doing. And do you know what happens in the text? In the text, what happens is the other 10 disciples find out that this is what James and John have done, and they ultimately are up in arms about this. They're angry about this, and a splintering, a schism starts to happen amongst the disciples that Jesus needs to address. And he addresses it like this. This is what he said. This is the antidote to spiritual superiority. He says, "You know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them." Exactly what James and John want to do, exactly as we can be tempted to do. And their high officials exercise authority over them. Let it not be that way with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be a servant, and whoever wants to be first must be the slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. So this is one of those issues that Jesus needed to deal with as he was trying to get his disciples to be effective fishers of people. He said the best fishing is done alongside people, not above people, looking down on people. Friends, may it be true of us that we model the incarnational ministry of Jesus, who lived with and among, not above, looking down. When we live that way, it destroys the ministry of Christ. And Jesus says, that has no part in the kingdom that I'm building. So that's the first one here. The second one that we see being dealt with is something I think a lot more of us may struggle with, spiritual insignificance. Spiritual insignificance. I wonder how many of us here don't get involved in the mission of Jesus in the world because we think we have little to offer. There were a number of disciples who felt that way. John chapter 6 begins to introduce us to that theme. John 6, 5 through 7 story of the feeding of the thousands, and this is what we read. This is John's version of it. When Jesus looked up and saw a great crowd coming towards him, he said to Philip, "Where shall we buy bread for these people to eat?" He asked this only to test him, for he already had in mind what he was going to do. Philip answered him, "It would take more than a half a year's wages to buy enough bread for each one to have a bite." Now notice, please, that Jesus singles out Philip here. He does that for a number of reasons. One of them, we assume, is because Philip was from Bethsaida, which was a town very close to where they were. But the problem here is Philip's response reveals that he's only thinking on a natural level. Remember, the text told us that Jesus had in mind what he was already going to do. The question being asked of Philip is, "Do you see what I want to do?" And the answer Philip gives back is, "No, I don't." And the reason he doesn't is because he's thinking on a natural level. Now, I want you to hold that thought because we're going to come back to that in the next point. But when you piece the text together, it's in this moment that Andrew steps up to the plate. Andrew probably heard Philip's response and recognizes, wait a minute, Jesus asks a question for a reason. He's doing something here, so what have we got? And you know the story, right? He brings a few loaves and a few fish to Jesus, and he says, "Well, we've got this, but what good is that going to do?" See, Andrew is convinced that what he's got in his hands isn't enough. Andrew's the type of believer who thinks that their gifting, what God's given them, is insignificant. Andrew was about to learn that what we bring to Jesus, Jesus can multiply. Andrew's job was to bring what he was given. Jesus' job was to multiply it to the masses. I really believe that this is an area where many of us struggle. We struggle with spiritual insignificance. Spiritual insignificance is based in this idea that Jesus cannot possibly use powerfully what you have to offer. I want to tell you that that's not the way Jesus thinks. That's not the way it is. Our responsibility is to bring what we've been given. Jesus' responsibility is to multiply it. And one of the biggest issues, I think, that impacts the fruitfulness of the church in fishing for people is too many of us are looking at what other people have been given rather than figuring out what God has given to me and how I can use it. Now, this is something that I've had to wrestle with in my own ministry. You'll note that I don't speak every week. I don't do that. I don't do that because the Bible says that there are multiple teachers that God blesses the church with, not just one. But you know what I've had to wrestle with in my own life, in my own heart, in my own humanity, in my own flesh? What I've had to wrestle with is when other people minister in such a way that God is all over them. Any of you relate to that? Over the last couple of weeks, you've seen the giftedness that we have. Corey was here. Corey could go over right now. He's with Pastor Panner. He's going to go on to visit Pastor Sandy. It's the first time we've been able to do that in 3 years. But why could we do that? Because we've got people like Nick, people like Spencer. Didn't they do a great job over the last few weeks? But what do you think can happen when it's pretty clear that God is empowering other people to do what you do? What do you think can happen in a person's heart? What do you think can happen in a person's soul if it's actually not right? See, as I've recognized the fact that God has blessed me to do a certain thing, as I've just surrendered that and brought that to Jesus and just focused on what I do really, really well and allow other people to do what they do really, really well, the church benefits. The church benefits. My call, my responsibility is to do what God has gifted me with. And that is so much easier to do when I focus on what God wants to do with me. It's so much harder to do when I compare what I can do with what other people do. The church doesn't work well when that's what we do. Now, in those moments where I've struggled looking at what God is doing with someone else, I've learned to appreciate the value of asking why. Why do I feel like this? What is going on in my heart that makes me feel so insignificant with my own gifting? Why? Why did Andrew feel like he felt like? And I'm reading into the text at this point, but how many of you who've got more than one child have had the experience that at some point in time, one of your children feels in the shadow of the other one? Any of you had that? Any of you got one child that's an extrovert, one child that's an introvert? Who gets most of the comments? The extrovert. Remember, in the story, Andrew was the one who took the lead at the beginning. Andrew was the one who introduced Peter to Jesus. And then as the story goes on, as probably was typically the case, loudmouth Peter got more of the opportunities and put himself in more positions to get more of the attention. Insignificance can creep in such a simple way like that. I wonder how many of you feel insignificant. You know what the solution to insignificance is? I think the solution to insignificance is recognizing that our responsibility is simply to bring to Jesus the things that he's given to us to do and leave the rest to him. And here's the thing. I think that when it comes to fishing for people, little things are actually the most powerful things. I want you to think about that. When it comes to fishing for people, the most powerful things are not the big things. The most powerful things are the little things. See, lots of little things done by a lot of people creates a culture of love and acceptance and compassion that helps people feel appreciated and valued. That people realize, I know that God loves me because you love me. One of the hard things about being away for the last couple of weeks was going to London and meeting up with a number of people that we did life with in our small groups 25 years ago. Why was it so hard? It was so hard because these people who were once key leaders in the church, a number of them have actually drifted away. Some of them don't know where their faith is anymore. One of the hard things about that is, as Vibka was having a conversation with one person, and we were just saying, just trying to figure out what was going on, one of the ladies turned to Vibka and said, you know, in all of this time, you're the only person who ever asks me how I'm doing. It's such a simple thing to actually ask someone, how are you? Where is your relationship with God at? It's such a simple thing to look around you and actually realize that the person who usually sits around you hasn't been there for the last couple of weeks. It's such a simple thing to actually write a text, send a note, make a comment on social media and just say, you know what, you really missed. So many of us actually think that we're insignificant spiritually because we haven't been gifted with these kind of big gifts. I want to tell you, the reason the church grows, the reason God transforms people's lives is because God, through Jesus Christ, through the incarnation, got involved in someone's life personally. It wasn't the big public displays. It was the personal touches. Jesus wanted his disciples to know that the personal touches matter. Personal touches, little things save lives. I heard about a woman who took her husband to the doctor's office. After his checkup, the doctor said, your husband is suffering from a really serious infection. But the husband was hard of hearing, and he looked at his wife and he said, what did he say? And his wife said, the doctor said you're really sick. The doctor continued, but there's good news. All you need to do is to reduce his stress. Every morning, give him a healthy breakfast. Now, for me, that's a British breakfast. When we were there, Vipka reminded me she doesn't like the fatty British breakfasts. The doctor said, be pleasant, be nice, be kind. For lunch, for dinner, make him his favorite meal. Be careful about sharing too many of your problems with him, because if you do, his anxiety level will rise. Don't yell at him, don't argue with him, just be patient. And most importantly, if you would just make it a priority to cater to your husband's every whim and do that for the next 6 months, I tell you, your husband will make a complete recovery. Doctor paused. The husband looked at his wife and said, what did he say? And the wife said, he said you're gonna die. I love that story because sometimes we think that the most important things are the big things, but it's actually the little things. And if all of us are simply willing to give even the little that we have to Jesus, we will be blown away by how he multiplies this in a harvest of souls. If you battle with spiritual insignificance, let me encourage you. Just thank God for what you've been given. And give it to him. And you know what? When you do that, he will increase your blessing over and over again. Spiritual insignificance. Number three, we see in his training of the disciples, spiritual deficit. This is where we go back and we pick up on the Philip story. I think another reason why many do not fish for people is because they're waiting for something more. They're waiting for something else. So we heard the one story with Philip where Jesus specifically singled Philip out and asked him a question. And in that question, it was revealed that Philip's problem was that he was thinking on the natural level. He couldn't think supernaturally. He just thought naturally. The next story really adds to this. It's John chapter 14. Now, in John chapter 14, Jesus is preparing his disciples for that time when he's not going to be with them anymore. He's just gone through all of this. If I go, I'll prepare a place for you. I'll come and take you to be where I am and all of this kind of stuff. And this is what we read, the encounter with Philip and the question Philip asked. Philip said, Lord, show us the Father, and that will be enough for us. Jesus answered, don't you know me, Philip? Even after I've been among you for such a long time, anyone who has seen me has seen the Father. How can you say, show us the Father? Don't you believe that I am in the Father and that the Father is in me? Philip stands for every disciple of Jesus who feels that they cannot step out and serve God because what they have is not enough. They need something more. Now, this passage is called a Johannine misunderstanding by commentators. There are a number of these misunderstandings in the book where Jesus says something and they misunderstand and he corrects them. These misunderstandings reveal a problem that the disciples have. And this misunderstanding is revealed here, is recorded here to show that in Christ, God had made himself fully known. As Philip was thinking about life without, life after Jesus, he was basically thinking, okay, what I've been given is not enough. I need something else. How many of us struggle to be effective for Jesus in the world? Because when we're in our life, going through our life, and problems come, it is very hard for us to think that seeing Jesus, knowing Jesus, provides us with all that we need. One reason that Philip felt the way he did is because he was too earthly minded. As someone has said, sometimes it's possible for a person to be so earthly minded that they have no heavenly good. This is Philip. He was so focused on what was going on in front of him, and he did not factor in the presence of Jesus. In crisis, let me ask you this. Are you quicker to draw unhealthy conclusions than you are quicker to look to Jesus? How many of us are too earthly minded to be any heavenly good? I think this is a real issue for us. when you face a crisis, when you face a challenging situation, are you so focused on the circumstances around you that you never lift your head up and realize that Jesus is with you? That when Jesus is with you, you have enough. Now, you remember as part of their training, Jesus sent them out, Matthew chapter 10. And as he sent them out into mission, he gave them this instruction, take nothing with you. Take nothing with you. No backpack, no money, no food, nothing. Why did he do that? Because he wanted them to realize that when he was with them, his word would work so powerfully through them that the people that they would meet would ultimately provide everything that they would need. How many of us are unwilling to step into a crisis, to step into an opportunity, because we're looking at the problem and thinking, I don't have enough? Part of his training of the disciples was getting them to realize that when Jesus is there, they have enough. How many of us refuse to do things until something happens? Until we have this or until we have that. This spiritual deficit in thinking hampers the ministry of Christ. It also hampers the dynamic nature of our relationship with Jesus. I can't tell you how many times I've had to do something wondering whether it's enough and just embraced what God was calling me to do and just seeing God work more powerfully than ever could have imagined him doing. Spiritual deficit. How many of you are here right now are waiting on God to do something before you do something? Philip was being taught that he had to trust Jesus, that with Jesus with him, he definitely had enough. Spiritual deficits. We don't know that Jesus is enough. What was Jesus' last words to his disciples? I will never leave you. I will never forsake you, and I will be with you until the very ends of the age. Friends, God's with you. If God is calling you to do something, trust that what he's given you is enough, and step into it. Lastly, spiritual disillusionment. Spiritual disillusionment. I think another reason people don't fish is because we're spiritually discouraged and we've lost our passion. I think this is a big one right now. Of all of the disciples, I think of Thomas when it comes to this. Now, Thomas received the nickname the doubter, but I think that that's slightly unfair. See, in John chapter 11, verses 15 and 16, there was a conversation happening with the disciples because Jesus had been asked and felt led to go to a certain town, and the route he was taking was leading him through a town where people were pretty violent in their opposition to him. And the disciples were concerned that if they went with Jesus on this route, that something would happen. And they're having this conversation. Do you know who spoke up in that conversation? John 11, 15 and 16, it was Thomas. And Thomas said, listen, you guys can do what you want, but I'm going with Jesus, even if that means I die with him there. This is Thomas in John chapter 11. And yet in John chapter 20, Thomas is the skeptic who's sitting down and unable to hear the words of testimony coming back from the women and then from Peter and John that Jesus was alive. He cannot hear it. Again, why can't he hear it? He cannot hear it because his experience of seeing Jesus died destroyed every idea that he had in his mind about what God was supposed to be doing in the world. And disillusionment set in. Discouragement set in. And rather than fight, he sat. I wonder how many people we've got in this room who are disillusioned right now for the very same reason that Thomas was. They had the idea that God should work in a certain way in their life, and much pain has come to them and their family because God has not worked in the way that they thought he should. I think a lot of us are there. I hear this over and over and over again. Spiritual disillusionment often causes God's people to sit. This week I was communicating with a pastor who felt exactly that way, discouraged. You know, we're in a season where the dropout rate in ministry is really, really high, and one of the key reasons for this is that people are discouraged. Pastors are discouraged. I read about a pastor who quit the ministry after more than 20 years of faithful, dedicated service and actually became a funeral director. He was interviewed for a magazine and asked, "Why did you do this?" I'm going to read you what he said. He said, "I spent 10 years trying to straighten out John, and he's still an alcoholic. Then I spent 3.5 years trying to straighten out Harold and Susan's marriage, and at the end of this, they still got a divorce. Later, I tried for 2 years to help Bob kick his drug habit, and he's still an addict. But at least at the funeral home, when I straighten them out, they stay straight." Pastors get disillusioned too. Over the last 3 years, I've had to fight disillusionment as Christian after Christian confuses secularized America with the Christian state. Nothing wrong with loving your country, but confusing this with the mission of Christ and then labeling me an agent of Satan is hard to take. Disillusionment can set in. Discouragement can set in. And when that happens, you can find yourself doing exactly what Thomas did. You come, but you sit. You just sit. In the beginning, you may well hope that Jesus will turn up, but at the end of the day, you're just there. Parents, I want to tell you, if that's you, that's a dangerous place to be. A dangerous place to be. The effect of us as parents living spiritually disillusioned on our children and on our children's children is worse than you can possibly imagine. Years ago, there was a young Jewish boy who greatly admired his father. That father was zealous in attending worship and religious instruction. They were a Jewish family, and he demanded exactly the same from all of his children. While the boy was a teenager, that family moved to another town in Germany. There was no synagogue in that town, and the key figures in that community all belonged to the Lutheran church, the state church, the Evangelische Kirche. Rather unexpectedly, one day, it was 1816, the father announced to the family that they were now going to worship at the Lutheran church. When the stunned family asked why, the father explained that changing religions was necessary to help his business. You see, at that point in time in Germany, the Jews were barred from holding high and influential positions in society. That young boy, you can read it yourself, was baptized in a Lutheran church, but he always wrestled with it. He grew bewildered, confused. His deep disappointment soon gave way to anger, and intense bitterness, he said, plagued him throughout his life. And that disappointed son, disillusioned by his father's lack of integrity, eventually left Germany and studied in England. History records that he sat day after day at the British Museum, formulating various ideas and writing a book. And in that book, he introduced a brand new way of viewing the world. Drawing on his experience from his father, he basically described religion as the opiate of the masses. One that could be explained simply in terms of influence, of economics, and of personal gain.